Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Jane, that sweatshirt is stolen valor.
This sweatshirt is not stolen valor, as I believe marriage gets me in here. I've spoken at Harvard and I went to the reunion, so.
All right, well, that's more than I've done. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. I am here with Jane Costin and ProPublica's Dara Lind. Election Day 2020 is 1 week away. And because we normally record on Tuesday mornings, but that would be weird with an election coming, we are actually going to do a special kind of live taping, me and Jane and Ella Nilsson, who's been covering a lot of Senate races and actually knows what's going on in things that are important, are going to do a kind of a live recording event to which contributors to the Vox program are invited. So if you like The Weeds, like Vox, like Parting With Money, want to know what's going on, this would be a great time to sign up and be a contributor. Until then, I've been thinking about the election and what my actual... I started thinking about this subject that Dara's going to enlighten us on when everybody was raring mad that Joe Biden would not give a crystal clear answer on court packing. Because I just didn't feel that uncertain as to like what the deal is with Democrats and court packing, which is that it just kind of depends on what happens. Whereas a big question I have that Democrats did not really answer during the primary, that Biden, for sort of contingent reasons, has not been pressed on by Trump or by the media self-starting, is like, what is he actually going to do with the incredible series of changes Trump has made to how the southern border is policed in the United States? Because on the one hand, this is a very emotionally motivating topic for sort of the college-educated liberal resistance base. Like, kids in cages is this like byword for Trumpian evil. But as we've discussed a million times on the show, that mentality is pretty detached from the specifics of what's actually happening. And, you know, our lived experience of Joe Biden being vice president and Barack Obama being president is that a Democratic administration does not really want to, like, give the runners the signal that like any kind of family unit should show up and make asylum claims at the southern border. So I feel like there's going to be a sort of sticky situation where Biden is going to want to unravel some stuff while also trying to continue discouraging people in a practical sense from arriving. And I know, Dara, I mean, you've been reporting on like what is the situation, what are the actual rules, and like what are the choices that we're going to face as we have a new administration. Hopefully at some point the pandemic wanes, and what's on the agenda.
So I think that you've identified the fundamental dynamic, which is that you know, should Joe Biden win the election, the people who are likely to be making these decisions are going to have to try to satisfy the goal of unraveling Trump's policies with a concern. But I would put this slightly differently, a concern that any increase in traffic across the US-Mexico border of people without papers is going to be seen as their fault. Like the actual role of, you know, sending a signal to people is one of the really important uncertain questions here. And, you know, the Trump administration, to various extents, is kind of already saying that any increase from this month, even before the election, is happening because people are excited because Joe Biden's going to give them amnesty. And the empirical evidence for that is lacking. There is some nuance that one could get into, but if
Biden does win, right, it's, if nothing else, just like marketing common sense from the standpoint of smugglers, right, to be like, oh, it's all different now, pay me money, Joe Biden's president.
Right. Okay. So there are three different strands here. One is that the $1 million question is what information people have when they make the decision to migrate. And that is mediated by information that they're getting word of mouth from people who have just made the journey. And it's also mediated to a certain extent by what they're hearing from smugglers. But smugglers don't, like, yes, from a marketing standpoint, if Joe Biden wins, there's absolutely a marketing argument for, like, hey, come on. On the other hand, there's also always an incentive to just, like, make stuff up. And there is, you know, there's kind of been some suggestive anecdotal evidence that, like, Trump's saber rattling about the border was also used as marketing by smugglers. Like, hey, you got to come through now because it's your last chance. So it's hard to predict what the kind of marginal effect of that is. The other thing that's really important is that it costs a lot of money to migrate to the United States. One academic who researches this, who I talked to, put it like, people aren't going to mortgage their houses for something that might could possibly happen. There is more suggestive evidence that when there's like a clear commitment, like the canonical example of this is when Bill Clinton was elected in 1992, he had been promising on the campaign trail to end the interdiction at sea of Haitians, which prevented them from getting to the U.S. to make asylum claims. And after the election, his transition team started getting intel that people were like building boats on Haitian beaches and like planning to come over, because there was this very clear, like, oh, this is the thing that's been stopping us from getting in, and this is going to go away. The transition's response was to announce that they weren't going to end that policy. They were going to, you know, review it, and it never actually got rescinded. That's the fear that Democrats continue to have. You know, it's something that was absolutely relevant to their response in 2014 when they dealt with the spike in the number of unaccompanied kids coming into the United States. It's impossible to disentangle the policy from the politics here, right? Because there is a policy argument that you want to strike a balance between not being too restrictive and expelling people who have legitimate asylum claims, but that if you're too permissive, too many people who won't ultimately qualify for asylum will like make this dangerous journey and will give revenue to criminal organizations and all of that. That is impossible to disentangle from the politics argument of, we have other things we want to do, and we're worried that if we're getting attacked for being soft on the border and getting overwhelmed by the border, that will keep us from doing the things we want to do. Those two arguments point in exactly the same direction, and it can be kind of tricky to figure out when people are making the empirical, this is what's causing it, and when they're making the political, it doesn't matter why it's getting caused. We need to do everything in our power to prevent it, because if it happens, it'll be our fault.
Right. And I think it's an interesting point that you make, that basically, if you have a immigration hawk that doesn't seem to discourage people who are like, you have to go now or else something will happen, or if you have someone who is perceived as being more lax on the border, whether or not that's actually true, because I think that our interpretation of being quote unquote soft on the border is utterly untethered to anything that's actually happening. But I wanted to ask you, so one of the things we've talked about is that, like, Stephen Miller has said that, oh, there's this drawer full of unsigned executive orders that are, I don't know, more powerful than anything we've ever seen, like tiny little Death Stars of immigration policy. But In terms of a hypothetical Biden administration, how much of what has happened over the last 4 years is locked into regulatory stone? And how much, when we're going down to the sub-regulatory level, how much is changeable within the first couple of months of a new administration? And what would that look like in the work that you've done?
So the answer to this like varies and varies in a way that, frankly, there was a wave of stories in like late August, early September that was a lot of like Trump has done so much that 4 years of Biden couldn't undo it all. And like that is true as a top line assessment, but it's not very useful as a top line assessment because that's basically saying like this massive, massive swath of policy can't all be undone. And it's difficult to get to a detailed enough level that it's useful without just getting overwhelming. That said, it did seem that some of the motivator of those stories was like Stephen Miller himself giving interviews to like Reuters, where he was like, well, the good thing about these regulations having taken so long is that they also take a long time to undo, which given the reporting from like 2018 that Stephen Miller was very frustrated with how slowly the regulatory process went, does seem to kind of... It seems a little bit like an effort to, you know, for kind of Stephen Miller to demonstrate that he has learned something about the regulatory process.
Also, just broadly, it's like nothing is ever totally undone, right? It's too much, right? It's like policy on every issue is a constant evolution. And like Trump has changed it a lot. Biden could change it a lot, too. And he's never said, right, I'm going to just like exactly recreate the status quo of December 2016. Democrats have always been notionally, right, like, we're going to let people make asylum claims, but also slightly hazy fairy dust. Like, something will happen in Central America that makes people no longer want to come here.
Yeah. So speaking broadly about immigration policy, the kind of the hardest stuff to do is going to be the stuff that's been written in regulation. The caveat there is that every regulation the Trump administration has put in place has been litigated, and most of that litigation is still ongoing in some form or another. So a super, super aggressive strategy would be to both drop the appeals of the court cases where they've lost. Like, even Trump-appointed judges have said, no, you can't enforce your regulation that says that you can't get asylum if you came through Mexico, you know, to get to the United States. It would not be that hard to drop that appeal. It would be harder for them to set, it's harder but not impossible for them to settle in litigation where they were previously winning. Like, the, you know, if they really wanted to do this, and this is a little bit, this isn't a regulation, but it's the first thing that's coming to mind, they could just settle over the Remain in Mexico policy before it gets to the Supreme Court, even though it's been allowed to go into effect. Or like they could settle on the regulation on how to define public charge when people are applying for green cards, even though they've been winning on that one. That's, you'd have to have a very aggressive DOJ because for understandable reasons, the DOJ doesn't generally like rolling over on lawsuits where it's been winning. So, you know, so that's something where you'd need to be spending a little bit of political capital. Everything else short of that is just like, how quickly does your bureaucracy run? There's absolutely nothing institutionally that's preventing them from, say, undoing the changes to the training curriculum that asylum officers are given on when to decide that someone is credible when they're telling their story of how they were persecuted. That said, it just changing those materials takes long enough, doing all the necessary levels of review takes long enough that like you would still be talking about a timeline of months. And that's if the message were sent from kind of all levels of the bureaucracy down, that this is a really big priority for us. And whatever else you have on your plate, like you should definitely be moving this as quickly as you possibly can. The easiest stuff to undo is the stuff that kind of is working on a day-by-day basis to begin with, which is generally like not how people are not how people go through the legal process in the US, but where they are to begin with, like what happens to them when they're arrested. The CDC order that has allowed for the expulsion of basically everybody coming into the US without papers since March wouldn't be that hard to undo. It's definitely a question, like epidemiologically, whether because Mexico is in such a worse position with regards to COVID than it was in March, whether that would be seen as a like an epidemiologically wise decision. Biden has promised to undo the Remain in Mexico program in the first 100 days, which is more relevant if he is undoing the CDC order than if he's not, because if he's saying, yes, you no longer have to wait in Mexico for your asylum hearings, but also we're sending you back to Mexico without an asylum hearing, like that's not a, you know, not a huge difference. But if he does undo both, it does, it would certainly increase the number of people who are allowed to stay in the United States, who are ultimately released into the United States pending asylum hearings. And there are these cooperative agreements with Central American governments, which in Guatemala had been put into place before the pandemic. Honduras and El Salvador have these agreements on paper that they'll do this that have that weren't operationalized yet, which say that what the U.S. can send asylum seekers who aren't from those countries to those countries and say, go apply for asylum here instead. It would be pretty easy to just like, to not resume doing that with Guatemala, to not start the process with Honduras and El Salvador if a Biden administration were elected. The question is whether that's something that they would see as just another like unacceptable Trump crackdown, or whether that's something that they would want to, you know, that they would be on board with as a more sustainable regional solution. And that's a very open question.
Let's take a break. And then I think it would be good to sort of delve into that.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media. Pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context. And it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So, to me, these diplomatic agreements are sort of the most interesting aspect of the Trumpian mix, right? Because they really achieve the like crass goal of externalizing the issue, whereby, I mean, as far as I can tell, like the politics of this asylum issue are that people don't like to see agents of the American government doing cruel things to children and families in need. But people also don't love the idea of lots of children and families in need arriving at the southern border and being released into the United States. So catching them up in Guatemala, where just like I don't think anything that has ever happened in Guatemala has like made front page news in the United States or like dominated cable television. You know, it has like incredible out of sight, out of mind capacity from the standpoint of like normie politics, like regular Democrats who I speak to, like rank and file people who were marching in the streets against family separation, have never mentioned to me like the in-transit detention of, you know, would-be migrants in Guatemala or southern Mexico. And Trump has one way of doing this, which is very kind of like arm twisty, we're going to make you go. But the highbrow Democratic answer on this, like going back to 2014, has always struck me as not actually that different from what Trump was doing, right? So like what they would say, if you spoke to congressional Democrats in 2015, 2016, 2017 about this, they'd be like, look, you know, we have laws, people have a right to declare asylum, but like the real issue here is we have to address these push factors in Central America. And, you know, they're like liberals, right? So like they don't say like we should bribe authoritarian regimes to kidnap people, right? Or like we should coerce desperately poor countries. But they're saying something is going to happen with the American foreign aid budget and perhaps American security assistance. And that thing is going to cause people to no longer come to the United States. And we've seen from Europe, right, a deploying of a similar tactic in North Africa without the like Trumpy antics.
Right, where the German government is like, wouldn't it be cool if you, North African country, maybe put these people in prison? I don't know, indefinitely, because maybe it would be awesome if they did not attempt to enter the European community. And then these North African countries are like, that sounds great to us. Please hand us money. So it's not unheard of.
The externalization of borders primarily for the purpose of dealing with what are called migration flows of people who, some of whom are asylum, or like probably have asylum claims, but not all of whom do, mixed flows, is a pretty common global feature. And it makes sense because it's the easy solution to the problem of, on the one hand, you have a bedrock commitment in national law to not turn away people who are on your soil who are fleeing persecution. On the other hand, you don't necessarily know and can't predict which of those particular people are in fact fleeing persecution or not. Like it cuts that Gordian knot. And I do think that it's really, just to underline, Matt, what you were saying about the out of sight, out of mind phenomenon, like I think that this is a little bit harder for people to grasp because it does seem that the Trump era as a whole has made Americans slightly warmer toward immigration, and certainly that like things like family separation in particular pointed a large amount of outrage at the treatment of people who were newly arriving that hadn't been there previously. But the bedrock assessment among establishment Democrats is that immigration in general is a winning issue for them, that the treatment of people who are in the United States, like the people who are settled unauthorized immigrants, is a winning issue and a high policy priority for them. And because that is not as obviously true for what you do with asylum seekers, and because there is a policy argument for, you know, for doing something other than being maximally permissive, that becomes seen as a potential distraction and a potential political liability. In 2014, the Obama administration, you know, announced a review of its enforcement policies in like March or April, which was widely seen to be preparation for expanding its deferred action programs so that more unauthorized immigrants would be protected from deportation. And then when the child migrant crisis hit in summer, it like had to spend its energy addressing that and getting Congress to appropriate the necessary money and demonstrating sufficient toughness to attempt to deter future asylum seekers. And the executive actions on immigration got pushed back till after the midterms. So whether that dynamic is still in place, obviously, like, we can't know for sure, but certainly looking at the way that the that Joe Biden has approached subjects like this. He sees this as a regional solution. And he was actually personally the point person in 2014 and like going to Guatemala and meeting with the heads of state of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador and saying, yes, we all agree that it's bad for parents to put their children into the hands of smugglers. We agree that these children should be returned to their parents, even though their parents were the ones who had like set them to begin with. We all agree that the long-term solution is for people to feel comfortable enough where they are that they don't need to, you know, that they don't need to emigrate. There are development policy questions of like whether if that policy had been allowed to stay in place, it would have worked. Like there was some suggestive evidence that like in El Salvador, a development policy did in fact diminish immigration in future. Obviously, there wasn't a whole lot of time between mid-2014 and a new administration coming into office, and development does take time. So it's possible that like true regionalism has never been tried and that isn't necessarily a sufficient answer. It certainly doesn't address the kind of short term, like, what do you do with the people who are coming now? What do you do with the people who are leaving next month? You can't necessarily tell them, oh, as long as you don't starve in the next 3 years, eventually things will be okay. And so while there are medium term ways to try to funnel irregular migration into like more regular migration, like expand people being able to apply for asylum in their home countries or get UNHCR to like set up more of a presence through the region so that more people can be resettled via the refugee resettlement system into the United States. Like there definitely is a short-termism, long-termism problem here. And it's not a problem that Democrats have ever felt the need to really like go out on a limb on because it's neither proven as policy nor politics.
And there are circumstances, right, in the literature where economic development at certain points on the curve leads to more outmigration because people obtain the financial resources to go, right? I mean, you don't see, right? Obviously, people don't leave. Beyond a certain point of economic development, people don't leave without papers, absent some kind of really acute, disastrous situation. Just like you see Puerto Rico and the United States, right? Like when Hurricane Maria devastates the island, a ton of people leave. But, you know, in the year before that, not so many. Puerto Rico is poorer than the mainland United States, but it's reasonably affluent kind of place. But it costs a lot of money to come, right? Like you don't see people from Chad trying to get to the United States generally because they can't, right? But you can read like Biden's policy agenda on Central America, which is very nice. It's $4 billion in money and it's the rule of law and it's anti-corruption. And it's like, it's great. You know, like we do all those things. Life in the Northern Triangle should be wonderful. But there's like, I think genuinely no reason at all to believe that like at the margin, slightly increasing the per capita income in Guatemala and Nicaragua and Honduras would reduce people's interest in exploring opportunities to leave, particularly because like the violence levels are so high that even if they're somewhat lower, like they're still really high. Like it's still going to be a good reason to leave. Like people are still going to be targeted by gang violence.
Yeah. And frankly, in the recent history of these countries, times of diminished violence have usually been shown shortly thereafter to be the result of government corruption and government government's agreements with organized criminal groups to like not crack down, or, you know, in the case of the mano dura policy in El Salvador, like very draconian policies that led to issues with human rights. It's very difficult to do like rule of law, human rights, and diminished violence all at the same time. But yes, no, I think that this is, I think, frankly, in practice, one of the things that I came away from the 2014 crisis really being sensitive to was the fact that in policy debates, you kind of get like plus 10 to gravitas for saying, well, we really need to address the root causes. And like, though that's a very easy way to build consensus, it's a very easy way to project that you are concerned with the well-being of the subjects of your policies. In cases like this one, where that has nothing to do with your short-term response, it can provide cover for a harsher or less humanitarian-minded short-term response than you would otherwise be able to get away with, because you're saying you can't accuse us of not caring about these, you know, of not caring about these asylum seekers. We care so much about them that we're not willing to let them put themselves in danger, and we're trying to make it so that they can stay in a safe place instead.
And I mean, to be blunt, the United States government has a extensive history of attempting to address quote-unquote root causes of problems in Central America. I mean, going well back.
But
that's what I mean, though. You know what I mean? Like, it requires a level of willful suspension of disbelief, I think, to be like, oh, okay, this time we're gonna, because of course you would look back, right? I'm sure if you asked Tony Blinken, like, what's going on, he'd be like, no, I mean the opposite of like the 5,000 times America has intervened in Central America and made things worse. But like, at the time the people were doing those things, they weren't saying like, I'm going to destabilize these countries and worsen the human rights situation. Like, the claim is always that you're addressing it. And I like to think, you know, as awful as like the Reagan administration's approach to Central America was, if they had a magic button that would have been like, drastically improve the economic and security situation in all of these countries instead of empowering right-wing death squads, like, I think they would have pressed the magic button. It's like, they didn't have a magic button. So they did what they did, and it was awful. And I think Biden will do better than that. But like, there's no way they're going to address the root causes. Like, they don't know how. And like, I don't know how either. Like, nobody knows how.
Fundamentally, what we are seeing in the like, quote unquote, Northern Triangle countries of Central America right now is something that the international refugee and asylum system wasn't built for. It was built for clear-cut cases of government persecution, because it did not imagine circumstances in which the most powerful institution over your lives would be a criminal organization and the government would be largely absent. It's impossible to disentangle fully from climate migration, which is, you know, just not a category of migration that even analytically exists, even in like international law exists. You know, we think of economic migration as being this opportunistic thing, like, oh, I want to make my life better and make my family's life better, rather than I can't survive where I am. And
right, but we're already in a scenario in which multiple places no longer
exist.
Yes,
right. Like, to the extent that that was ever true, it's less true when it's like literal starvation. So it does, it scrambles the framework we have. And, you know, that again is why the smart money medium to long term is, we've never had a meaningful refugee resettlement infrastructure for people, for places that are close to us, and we should fix that because these problems aren't going to go away. And frankly, refugee resettlement as a process is just a little bit better suited to thinking about people as like in mortal peril, rather than trying to fit them into boxes of how exactly are you being persecuted. There's some of both, but it's less of the, okay, the most important thing we can do for you right now is put you into a legal process where we litigate whether your family was prominent enough to count as social distinction under the third prong of what counts as a particular social group. Like, it's not that the US doesn't have easy answers, it's that there aren't easy answers, and the US is in a position where the problems of other countries, of these particular other countries, are inevitably going to affect the US, whether it would like them to or not. It's not Australia where like you can just interdict everybody at sea. So the worst case scenario, getting back to what kind of the short-term concerns about the optics of the border in January 2021 are, is like, this is what we've been dealing with Central America in a situation where Mexico is doing pretty okay. Like, there's an argument that I find fairly persuasive that one of the big reasons you see an increase in Central American migration after the Great Recession is that smuggling organizations turned their attention away from the Mexican market because they didn't have the demand to emigrate from Mexico that they'd had previously. If Mexico is looks as bad coming out of the pandemic as it might, given how bad the pandemic has been there, given that the economic situation was already pretty shaky under the López Obrador administration in the time before that, given that the security situation was already deteriorating in parts of the country, like, Mexico is closer to the U.S. than Central American countries are, and it's much bigger. And so even a marginal change in the number of people emigrating from Mexico is going to have a much more outsized effect on the number of people coming into the United States than a change in the number of people emigrating from Central America would.
Well, and, you know, Trump has approached the COVID border situation in an almost entirely pretextual way. I mean, which we can tell is pretextual because he has so little interest in COVID control through other means.
We also know it's pretextual thanks to some really excellent reporting from both my organization and Reuters and the Wall Street Journal that, like, career scientists at the CDC did not want to sign off on things that were ostensibly CDC policies at the border, that those had come from DHS and the White House, and that they were essentially strong-armed into going along.
Right, but I just mean, like, the political disposition of the Trump White House is clearly to impose a lesser set of restrictions on human activity than public health officials generally recommend, right? It's not, like, inconceivable that you would say, no, the CDC is wrong, we need to be more restrictive than that. But, like, that's just, like, not what Donald Trump thinks about the CDC, right? Whereas Biden has campaigned very clearly, very strongly on the principle that we need to make virus control our top priority as a nation. And in the context of an administration that's actually doing that, right, you know, a federal mask mandate in the jurisdictions where you're able to do it, as he said he would be, like, one-on-one meeting with governors to tighten up rules that are outside federal responsibility. You know, this, that, and the other thing, right? In that context, very draconian border policies fit really, really nicely. Like, Canada closed the border to Americans at one point during this process. Like, not because, like, Justin Trudeau is a crude nationalist, but, like, that's you know, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, who is sort of an all-around immigration restrictionist. But just, like, border closures have been a feature of pandemic management from a lot of people, and at least in the shortest term, provides a way to sort of punt on a lot of these conceptual questions, right? Like, it's very unlikely that Mexico is going to have the world's best vaccine distribution process. Like, that would be odd. So you should have an extended period of time in which, you know, there will be some equities involved in saying, like, well, we gotta just close this down for public health reasons.
Again, it's really tricky to disentangle the policy from the politics here, because in general, public health experts tend to be very, very dovish on immigration and believe that, like, travel restrictions aren't, you know, are very rarely the right way to go about things. You could puzzle your way through to an argument that, like, when we're talking about people who are being smuggled in tractor trailers, you know, that are, like, poorly ventilated, and this is an argument that the Trump administration is, like, now making in a kind of, like, gotcha sort of way, that the people who are coming to the, like, who are, like, being smuggled to the U.S. are less likely than most to be protected from COVID. And so there's a particular risk there. It's also true that when keeping a policy in place would, like, solve or defer more problems than it creates, it's much harder to change the policy away from it. But what really do want to hammer home is that, you know, I mentioned the kind of, like, interaction of the CDC order with the Remain in Mexico program, like, in passing earlier, but The Remain in Mexico program is the rare example of something that hasn't activated large swaths of the American public in outrage, but has gotten foothold within the Democratic establishment as like something that is bad and needs to change. Like a lot of Democratic members of Congress have visited the de facto refugee camp, which the only reason it's not a refugee camp is refugee camps are actually like governed in Matamoros. You know, there is concern for the conditions in which people are waiting in Mexico. There's concern for the fact that like ostensibly they've been promised court dates in the United States, but those court dates are now going to be stretched out into like 2022. If you keep the CDC order in place and don't do anything to address those people, like the Matamoros camp has already shrunk by several hundred since the beginning of the pandemic, because the combination of waiting in terrible conditions, waiting indefinitely in the midst of a pandemic, and like the flooding and hurricanes that they've had to deal with in the Rio Grande Valley, you do get a certain sense of attrition. And ditto in Tijuana, there are people who are headed home. There are also people who are just trying to cross through the Sonoran Desert, which is much more dangerous because it's less likely that they'll get caught. So there is a cost to waiting in a humanitarian sense. And if those people are high priorities to provide redress to, that is something that is going to kind of run smack dab into the, well, it's going to be easier for us to not solve this problem just yet.
Second break, do the white paper.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries.
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Our paper today, Voting with Their Sandals, Partisan Residential Sorting on Climate Change Risk by Asaf Bernstein, Stephen Billings, Matthew Gustafson, and Ryan Lewis. So this, you have probably seen, if you follow the news, some kinds of articles somewhere in which people will say that like real estate prices, you know, already show motion due to climate change flood risk, or insurance companies are pricing in climate change. And the sort of optimistic read on this that I've always had is that like people have their like partisan politics brain. And then there's the like, what do you actually do? And you see in markets that like people are reacting to real changes that are happening. And it gives me sort of some hope that there's like a version of reality in which people will acknowledge problems and try to address them. This paper, by using much more detailed information from Zillow and all kinds of micro data about who people are, And also distinguishing places that are presently susceptible to floods from places that will disproportionately become more susceptible as sea level rises. They showed that there is a meaningful partisan difference, that Democrats, with their real estate decisions, act like they believe the sea will be higher in the future and select away from properties that would be negatively impacted that, whereas Republicans just see a bargain opportunity and do not, right? And so it's the opposite of the kind of bigger picture stories I've seen. It's not that prices don't move in response to climate change, like many Democrats are a large share of the population. And so what they think about things, you know, matters economically. But the Republicans do not have some like secret, more practical side of themselves in which they acknowledge this to be a real problem. They put their money where their mouth is, or their sandals in the chosen metaphor of the authors of this paper. And, you know, just kind of assume that the ocean will not go up, which seems bad. My understanding is very strongly that it will. Like a Republican Senate candidate, I am not a scientist. But unlike them, I have heard what the scientists say. And it's really not very ambiguous on this point.
I found it interesting, though, that the data indicates that the kind of residential sorting that they are researching appears to exist among the people who own the property, whether or not they live there or not, but not among people who rent the property. And as a long-term renter, I think a lot about these things. But I also found it interesting how much of this had to do with the idea of perceived risk over time, that this type of partisan-based sorting does not necessarily exist with respect to immediate flood risk. Like if you are thinking, I would like to buy this property on the edge of the Everglades in the midst of hurricane season, that's not what we're thinking about. We are thinking about trying to project over time. And I think it's fascinating because you see sometimes like, oh, the Obamas bought a property in Martha's Vineyard, which won't exist in whatever X amount of time. But that's not exactly what we're talking about. What we're thinking about is like how these decisions are shaped, thinking over time, especially with regard to like specific regions and what we expect from those, from climate change on those specific regions.
Right. I do want to highlight that owner-renter split because it's, I mean, it makes sense for what the paper is examining, right? Like they're looking at how assessment of climate change as an issue like filters into investment decisions. But thinking about it as a partisan sorting thing kind of fuzzies that a little bit because it makes it a little bit easier to see this through the lens of Republicans are like places where that are deliberate, that are exposed to risk, like Republicans are choosing to live in those places. And so there isn't necessarily an obligation to protect people from the consequences of their decisions if they're the ones who are choosing to ignore the science, which like isn't necessarily true for renters, both because they don't necessarily have the economic power to like choose where they buy a house, and because as the paper shows, there isn't a sorting difference. And so you see this right now with regards to like which, you know, the idea that like blue states give, you know, give money to the federal government and red states take away money from it, like the kind of threats to solidarity posed by, you know, you're living with the consequences of your own ideology are always limited by who gets to make decisions based on ideology rather than based on other material factors. And in this case, kind of results in a worst case scenario for the renters who neither get to avoid the consequences of climate change nor get to be understood as caring about it or, you know, have being able to take measures to mitigate it if they so chose.
So they show, right, one thing you can look at is how vulnerable is a property to a storm surge right now, right? And they show that that impacts people's like real estate valuations, regardless of partisanship, right? So like Republicans are not in denial about the fact that like there are places that are currently susceptible to flooding. And if you're renting, like you can move, right? So you know, you should be short-term oriented about that, right? It's that the places that become drastically more vulnerable, if you see a foot or two of sea level rise, there's this incredible partisan split. Now, if you're a renter, right, I mean, the sea level is rising, but it's not rising like next week. The situation will be dramatically different, right? So, like, it's fine. Like, you could move next year, right? That's like one of the big benefits of renting. But I mean, it's I don't quite know how to say it. It's like, it's not shocking exactly that like Republicans believe what they claim to believe, but it is a little bit distressing, especially because, you know, the smart Republican position has shifted to like climate change is real, but the Green New Deal solution is too drastic and we need to do like X, Y, and Z mitigation measures and blah, 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 which, you know, there are versions of which I think are more and less reasonable than others. But like, it is all premised on assessing the fact that like there will in fact be harms, right? Like if you see, there's a phenomenon called solution aversion, right? If a problem is real, then to solve it, you need to do X, Y, and Z. But you don't want to do X, Y, and Z. So you deny that the thing even is a problem. And that's where, I mean, this study to me, it says that like that's where rank and file conservatives are. Like they're not up for brainstorming like different ways of thinking about this problem than Bernie Sanders might have, because they have sincerely, like with their investment dollars, committed themselves to the view that like that the problem is fake. Not that like I reject the solutions that I've heard, but I am worried about the flood. So then if somebody has a more appealing solution, I might take it. Like they seem quite dug in a way that's like, that's challenging, right? Because as much as people will paint an optimistic picture about like, well, we'll create all these clean energy jobs and blah, 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 blah. Like fundamentally addressing climate change involves doing some things that you would not do if not for the fact that climate change is real, right? Like the parts that are just good, like that's great. Like it's win-wins are real. Like it's amazing, but it's like, it's really bad if certain parts of the world become much more susceptible to flooding and it justifies actions that would not otherwise be justified. But if you're convinced it's fake, like if you're so convinced you're going to tie up your retirement in a rental property that's going to be underwater, like that's not great.
It is not great.
It is not.
All right. A lot of not great stuff here. But, you know, it's good. Thanks, guys. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors, to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. Check us out at the live show on Election Day. That'll be really cool. And the Weeds will be back on Friday.